Hare Krishna. I'd like to welcome all of you to our Hare Krishna farm, and having taken 2 days off from your busy schedule, I'd like to introduce His Holiness Devendra Swami. Devendra Swami was born in New York and was quite an extraordinary student. He received scholarship all throughout his education, and he graduated from Yale University in economics. He told us once that they paid him $25,000 a year as scholarship 30 years back, which is and as you know, Yale University is known for producing most number of CEOs and presidents of America and all over the world. Maharaj had a corporate career. At that time he came across Prabhupada's books, which had a very great influence on his life. Maharaj, after having understood the true goal of life, human birth, and having true compassion in his heart, he chose to dedicate his life in the service of his and in the service and the mission of his spiritual master, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. And he abandoned his corporate career. At that time he joined Prabhupada and he took sannyas. Since then he has been preaching all over the world, and namely countries like America, South America, Europe, Russia, Ukraine, and India, and Australia, New Zealand. He's very popular, especially among the young people. Whenever he is in Bombay or in India, in Delhi or Calcutta, he gets a lot of people attending his lectures. He is invited in many prestigious universities. I happened to be in one of the lectures when he was giving in IIT Bhawai. There are a couple of thousand students attending. And so many other colleges, medical colleges and companies also. Maharaj is an author and a researcher. Few of us have read his book, Searching for Vedic India, which is more systematic than any of the science papers I have read. And seeing him as a sannyasi, and have studied so many, have given so many references, makes us feel, you know, us science students as quite minuscule. We are very glad and very grateful that His Grace Devendra Swami is here and sparing his time. So, I'd like to thank Devendra Swami. Thank you very much for us.
Some introductory mantras, and then we will proceed with our discussion, which I hope will be of value for you in terms of how to position your life. Some of the things that we'll discuss will be challenging. I hope you won't mind. I'm thinking of a comment by a famous American comedian who said, "My mind's already made up. Don't try to confuse me with the facts." Now, I know that you all are very open-minded, otherwise you wouldn't come here. Nevertheless, you'll be shocked to perceive that there are many underlying assumptions which are troubling you and impeding your spiritual progress. We're going to try to touch upon those in a gentle way so that you can become relieved of their burden. Om Yena Chimanandasya Ganjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gudavay Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nithananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasani Go Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Yes, as Nityananda Priya was telling you, I came from an unlikely educational background for taking up my line of work that I'm doing now, but maybe not unlikely. As Nityananda Priya said, Yale University is famous for producing the majority of CEOs and presidents in the USA. In fact, this recent presidential election was simply between two Yale graduates. I remember my last month at Yale. I went to see my dean, who's in charge of students of my particular section of university. And I said to him, I don't see a place for myself in this materialistic society as it is. And he looked at me without batting an eye and said, you are a Yale man. You will influence the world. So maybe he was right. But not in the way that he thought. Now, I just come from Vrindavan and Delhi, and I spoke in Noida, a suburb of Delhi. I'm aware of certain conceptions that impede our spiritual progress. Of course, naturally, you're curious about Vedic knowledge and the spiritual lifestyle. Still, there's a fear. If I become too spiritual, more than a few minutes a day, my material goals will become frustrated. I'll even risk being a material failure. In other words, so many of us may be thinking that it's very impractical for being genuinely spiritually concerned. We're going to try to look at that belief and see it for what it is. What is progress? This is a very important point to understand. Because you'll feel guilt about pursuing real dharma. When I say real dharma, I don't mean kind of folk traditions handed down from your great-grandmother. Real dharma is very solid knowledge and practice. This is the glory of India that is not known. Why is it not known? For two reasons. One is the fault of India, and the other is the fault of Europe. You have to spread the blame equally. Of course, amongst, shall we say, young Indian activists, they always want to blame Europe. But India must also assume its blame. in that it has relegated its deep heritage of extraordinary knowledge to the status of folklore. By not properly applying Dharma, by not properly applying the Vedic knowledge, it's become very reduced, very weakened. So therefore, naturally you're going to think, oh, didn't my grandmother talk about these things when I was a little person? They were nice stories from the Mahabharata. Stories from the Ramayana.
Yes.
But what does that have to do with real life as it's lived now? I believe so many of you are students, and so you have to be competitive, not only in your academic studies, but also in your preparation for the job market. So you're worried, if I become Krishna conscious, will I lose my competitive edge? Will I fall behind and become a useless person? Unfortunately, because of a lack of awareness of the Vedic knowledge in India and its true import, these insecurities have come upon you. And then, of course, Europe gets the blame because of a concerted effort to devalue Vedic knowledge in order to keep India as a colony. The British specifically and purposely had this as their goal. I've documented that in my book. How the British Raj paid scholars, beginning with the famous Max Muller. They paid him money to purposely devaluate anything that was Vedic. The British are very clever. That they were thinking that in order to domesticate India, in order to control India, we've got to disparage, or we have to belittle the educated elite of India, which were the Vedic sages, the Vedic scholars at that time. The British calculated, and you can see documents of this, it's not just some kind of wild accusation. No, all their plans are very well documented historically. The British are very meticulous about bureaucracy. They taught that to India. So it's all there in print. The best way to control India is to devalue its religious leaders. Because as long as the people keep revering their spiritual leaders, they'll never adopt the Western version of progress. So the British Raj paid so many scholars to devalue anything Indian. When the Europeans first discovered Vedic writings like Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, they were very enthusiastic, particularly the Germans. But that enthusiasm faded very quickly as British colonial motivations took over the situation. So what you have now in India is still the result of a few hundred years of purposeful devaluation. An effort that many young Indians don't even know. They don't realize it happened. And it may be when it's brought up, it must be simply radical, you know, radical Indian politicians talking about these things. It may be so that in many cases there are simply radical Indian politicians bringing this forward, but still the truth is there, and you can study it, that there was a great purposeful campaign to poke fun, to ridicule anything Vedic. Now, how do you want to use that truth of what happened, that's up to you. But it is the truth, and it is documented. Never mind what political party you want to align yourself with in India. Nevertheless, that effort to
ridicule
everything Vedic did happen.
And it still
affects scholarship today.
So,
I'm explaining this to you
so that you will have an idea of why you have these notions of embarrassment and hesitation for approaching Krishna consciousness.
This way.
Yeah. Why you have embarrassment and hesitation for approaching Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is just a contemporary
word
describing
Sanatana Dharma,
the eternal occupational duty. You can use the contemporary expression Krishna consciousness, or you can use the traditional vocabulary Sanatana Dharma. Now, why is it that people have such a distorted conception of what progress is? This is what you're really struggling with. So please, let us identify the battlefield. The battlefield is one of who decides what progress is. I think you may have to turn this off.
Why is it that so easily we've all accepted a certain approach to life as progress? I wonder how many of you thought of that. Yes, it's true that the Western conception of progress has been very vigorously achieved. That conception of intense economic emphasis, extraordinary technological advancement in a very narrow way that has assumed monstrous proportions. So this is what is intoxicating everyone's minds now. Oh, the economy, economic hallucination, technological obsession, and all other aspects of the human experience are ignored. And then you look at India, and there you see that life is lived in a much fuller way. But that's now actively being destroyed by the assuming of the very obsessive Western conception of progress. You want to judge whether your life is successful? How much is in your bank account? What kind of car do you drive? How many gadgets do you have in your home? Never mind that your family has broken apart. Never mind that your children are deranged and depressed. Never mind that your society is full of drugs and psychological problems. Why worry about that? Look at your home appliances. Look at your currency exchange rate. Look at your investments. How could any intelligent person fall for this? But it's very hypnotic. It's very intense. Just like you know when you watch television. Very intense. When I was in Delhi, just to do some research, I just turned on the television to see what television is like now. Every couple of years I do this. I was shocked. It's actually becoming more intense than American television. It's like the Indians are saying, look, when it comes to materialism, we can outdo everyone. This television mentality is in our minds. We may not recognize it, but it's there. In terms of our accepting a very narrow vision of what is progress. Technological expertise in a very narrow way. economic obsession. The economy, the economy, technology, technology. And then extreme individualism. You decide what you want to do. Don't consult anyone. Everything is up to you. You decide what is right. You decide what is proper. You decide what is dharma. And you get this sense of empowerment. Let us throw off the shackles of antiquity. Let us throw off the shackles of tradition. And it'll just be me and technology and the economy. This is progress. Now, I'll point out to you all a glaring contradiction. Please try to recognize it. In New Zealand, where I'm based, where I base my travels from, many corporate leaders have told me that if we are given a choice to hire someone, and the applicants are Indian or Chinese or New Zealander, first we'll go for the Indian. If we can't get the Indian, we'll go for the Chinese. Last of all, we'll take our own people. So why is that? Who can answer? Why? Yes.
Maybe Indians are less prone to alcoholism and they are hardworking, as they say.
Yes?
I think they are more passionate in achieving something. They are more dedicated to the work and they are even ready to compromise their family life and their enjoyments for earning money.
They are more adaptable to the situation which brings them to, like they can accommodate to the changes.
More trustworthy.
Cheap labor and better
performance. Anything else? All right, now I'll ask you, where do these qualities of sacrifice, responsibility, duty consciousness, modest sense control, as someone was pointing out, they're not so prone to alcoholism, drugs, and their lives aren't shattered like so many Western lives. Where do all these good symptoms come from? Right. So you see, this is the contradiction. What is making the Indian population such viable employees is the very thing the Indians are rejecting. And soon, if you go on rejecting, you're going to wind up like everyone else. So you're rejecting the very culture that's given you the advantage. That Vedic culture provides stability, family tradition, reasons why you should be responsible, why you should control your senses. But the full import of that Vedic system has been forgotten, and so you're just clinging to the outward manifestations without understanding the deep import of it all. And therefore, gradually outward manifestations are drying up. As you sit before the television and have all these things beamed into your head. So therefore, in New Zealand, I'm seeing the lives of the children of Indians who come to work in New Zealand. The children are completely bewildered. The children tell their parents, we don't want to be Indian. We don't want to go back to Gujarat and visit our grandparents. Forget it. We want to be Kiwis. Don't give us this old folklore. We want to have parties like the rest of the teenagers. We want to have free contact with the opposite sex like every normal person. Why are you pushing these outmoded ways upon us? And the parents are completely bewildered. The parents have no idea what to say. Except, well,
your great grandmother in Gujarat didn't live like this. What do the children care about that? Who cares about great grandma? You know, we're in New Zealand. And I'm sure the same thing is true in Australia. Mm. The parents have no ability to explain to their children why you should have a life of integrity, sense control, responsibility. Because the parents have just some vague external understanding of Vedic culture. They don't understand the import. The import of a lifestyle of responsibility, obligation, sense control, integrity, is so that you have a proper social framework for becoming Krishna conscious, for practicing Sanatana Dharma. You take the horse away from the carriage doesn't move. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Vedaishta Sarvaya Ahameva Veja. By all the Vedas I am to be known, Bhagavan Sri Krishna says. That means the goal of Vedic culture is Krishna. Vedic culture is Krishna culture. You take away the conclusion and you're just left with a car without the engine. And then gradually everyone forgets, why are we following this? So therefore you have the young Indian generation in their teens and increasingly in their 20s now who are falling victim to alcoholism, broken families, wild behavior. Ah, yes, England. Just go to England, you'll see this. Perhaps England has the oldest Indian immigrant community. Go to London. I know, I talk to the young there in England. They tell me. One teenage girl, she's about 18, she's telling me, you know what we do? When Diwali comes, all the teenagers get together and make their own Diwali celebration. We tell our parents, we're going to have a youth Diwali celebration. We're going to rent a big hall, and 5,000 youth are going to come together for Diwali. And the parents say, oh, very nice. We're also doing our once a year puja. That's very good. We must keep up with the traditions at least once a year. So, what do the kids do when they get to their hall? They just have a wild party in the name of Diwali. Drunkenness, lecherous behavior. And the parents have very little idea what's going on. They were telling me, these teenagers in London, what we do is we tell the girls say, we tell our parents, we have to study for an exam, and therefore I'm going over to the house of my girlfriend, yeah, and we're going to, you know, the girl's going to get together and study for the weekend. And of course the parents are, very good. I'm very proud of you that you're so responsible in your studies. So the girl leaves home to stay with her girlfriends, wearing modest clothing. As soon as she gets out the door at her girlfriend's house, they put on their skimpy party clothes, and they party the whole weekend. They told me, sometimes even the parents have an idea of what's going on, but the parents they can't say anything because they're just bewildered. And also the parents have to be concerned with their social standing. So they don't want to kind of just admit to themselves that my daughter may be doing all these wild things. It's like the parents have to delude themselves in order to keep up the social standing. So everyone's playing this game of let's pretend. So once again, please recognize this contradiction, this huge contradiction. The very things that are making Indians attractive as employees are being destroyed. So, if you're actually a practical person, if you're actually expert in living your life, then put 1 + 1 together and get 2. The things that are making me attractive as an employee come from a culture, a tradition. So I should then get to the bottom of that culture and tradition. That is being practical.
Why is there the culture of stability, responsibility, integrity, proper family obligations? Why is there that in India, although it's being destroyed now? It's there because Vedic culture means establish stability and obligations so that people can be sane in their human dealings for the purpose of making spiritual advancement. But if you simply use that stability and sanity for economic purposes, you'll lose the focus, and gradually you'll become victimized by the same things that are victimizing everyone else. So this is the paradox. The things that have propelled you to the forefront back, your backs are turning on. These are backward. The very thing that provides you with your advantage. It's a very, very distressing situation. Sometimes you may protest. What's so bad about modern Indian culture? Right now, India is an economic powerhouse. It could be that in the next 10, 20 years, India and China will dominate the world's economies. Just like I was shocked to read in the newspaper yesterday that IBM is probably going to sell all its computer business to a Chinese firm for $1 billion. Yes. Yes. I was shocked. They're just not making so much money out of it. They're making more money offering corporate services. So all their computer line, ThinkPad, laptops, they're rumored. And when they were asked about the rumors, they said, it is our company policy neither to affirm nor deny rumors. You know what that means? Yes, they're going to divest themselves of their whole computer line. The very corporations, the pinnacle of America that started the whole personal computer rage is now going to divest itself of it because it's just not profitable. And they're selling to a Chinese firm, Legend. What is actual progress? This you have to ask yourself. What has the Western conception of progress done? Can we have some more air in here? What are the social, what are the individual effects of that progress? If you're practical, if you're an intelligent person, please focus on the effects. Don't just become mesmerized by progress, technology. Look at these societies. So what you see as modern contemporary Indian culture is actually just the West bringing in its conceptions for the purpose of increasing market share. India and China are the last markets. They're not flooded with all the consumer goods that are everywhere else. So if you're an intelligent capitalist, you're always looking for the new markets. India is a huge market. That's why when Clinton was president a few years ago, he came to India. Remember, he went to Delhi. And what did he say? Don't worry. We're increasing the number of visas. Don't worry. We'll take all your IP wallahs. We're increasing so much number of visas. There's always a catch, though. A month later, the Secretary of State, Powell, came, and he said, open up your markets. Nothing is for free in this world. Yeah. Yes, we'll increase the number of visas. We'll take all your brightest IT people. And in return, you open up your markets to it's not even American anymore, multinational, consumer goods. So make sure before you start defending the current version of contemporary Indian culture, make sure you understand where it comes from. I've been all over India. I've been to India at least 50 times over the past 30 years. And I've seen that people in simple villages are actually so content and happy. They have the contentment and the happiness that the richest person in America doesn't have. And I'll quote statistics. As you know, I always quote statistics because it's like, he's just saying like that, you know. These swamis, they, you know, they're always trying to push the Vedic Dharma. We are analytical persons, we're scientific persons. All right, you want facts. The UN just did a study, a psychological study of who are the happiest people in the world. And guess who won top place?
Bangladesh,
the poorest country in the world. Yes. Bangladesh, the poorest country in the world, got top honors as having the happiest people psychologically, according to current psychological standards. What do you think about that? This should make you think. I was telling at the Melbourne Mahabrahmandir, I had read of the testimony from, well, supposedly he's now just the third richest man in the world. Supposedly Bill Gates is only number two now, because the man who founded the IKEA chain, he's number one. So, anyway, so number three, the Oracle Man, I call him, he's always very angry. Why so much glorification given to the Microsoft man? I'm also so successful. So, he's giving his autobiography, his testimonies. So, I am so happy. Believe me, I am so happy. I am worth $23 billion. I hardly recommend this to everyone. I am so happy. I can have whatever I want. Boats, airplanes, my airplanes. I can have airports. I have reached the pinnacle of life. I wholeheartedly recommend this to all. I'm a very happy man. Do you really believe that?
No.
He can't sustain any lasting personal relationships. You can just look at his face and see behind the eyes the emptiness, the alienation. So is this the kind of progress you want? But I know what you're thinking. Let us take the good of the Western conception of progress right? and not take the bad things. How do you do that? Tell me, show me this theory in practice. You are scientific persons. You're not sentimentalists. Show me proof. Show me how this is happening. It's not. Once you catch a hold of this tiger, it devours you. And that's what's happening now. You can see that. You all will marry, if you haven't already. What will you tell your children? Don't be like the Australians here. Be very responsible, be very methodical in your life. How can you tell them that when all day long they're watching TV, going to movies, listening to the radio? They're going to just turn on you. You don't know what you're talking about. You're old-fashioned. You're a relic. You'll bring them over to visit your parents in India, and the children will just, when are we going to come back to Australia? I can't stand it here. It's like, maybe some of you know Budimanta. Yeah. His wife wanted to get the kids back to India before they got too attached to Australia. So the kids were telling me, he has two sons, I said, what do you like better, India or Australia? And they looked around to make sure that their father was listening. They said, Australia. We don't like it here, the pollution, the noise. We like life in Australia. It's free. Of course, on the other hand, they're devoted. They're very devotional kids. But still, the powerful effects of growing up in a materialistic society are so great that they have to be affected. What are you going to do about your kids?
You know, I, your father, lived a great sacrifice. Your grandparents sent me, their son, to study in Australia. I studied hard, working at the same time, and I excelled in all my studies. I got a good job, and now I married your mother, and then we have you children. So much obligation, responsibility has gone on just so you could have what you have now. What are your children going to tell you? Very nice, father. Very nice, mother. We want to live our own life. So let us try to get to the depths of Vedic knowledge rather than just take advantage of the external, the superficial, for momentary economic gain. Let us try to understand what actually Western so-called progress brings about. Here, I'll give you some statistics I've recorded in my book. So, because you can't have one side without the other side. You have to understand where Western progress is leading to. It destroys everything in its path, psychologically, ecologically. Listen to this. Time magazine reported that the USA in the past 40 years has undergone a 300% increase in teen suicides. And in the past 50 years, the USA has undergone a 1,000% increase in childhood depression. Is this the kind of progress you want? Of course, you don't see this when you watch American television shows. Life looks so casual there. It looks, you know, the Americans are always joking and they're just, you know, at ease about everything. That's how the television presents. But here you're noticing the statistics. More than three times as many American children now suffer from mental and behavioral disorders as compared to only 20 years ago. Since only 1980, three times as many American children now suffer from mental and behavioral disorders. Furthermore, a survey of the brightest American teenagers found that almost a fourth of them had considered committing suicide. The brightest. They have this book in America called Who's Who in America, and they publish it about to cover different sectors of the society. So one volume is about the most brilliant high school students. So a fourth of those most brilliant high school students listed in Who's Who in America have contemplated suicide. Why? They say depression and school pressure. The depression comes from not having any meaning in life. And then there's the school pressure to get ahead. And another interesting point is that less than a fourth of these top achieving high school students reported that their families ate dinner together every night. So this is the progress. So you have to understand what you're biting into. Now, we're not denying that the particular type of scientific expansion, technological development that you've seen recently is incomparable. We're not denying that. But our point is it covers such a narrow spectrum of the human endeavor. It's a complete distortion. So we're not saying throw away your IT, throw away your computers, throw away all your scientific development. No, we're just saying fine, but that area of development is such a narrow bit of the total human experience. And in order to properly understand Vedic culture, you have to understand the whole of the human experience. So hopefully, at this point, you have got ample reason to doubt whether you should wholeheartedly go down this tragic path, which produces ecological destruction. All the scientists say it is not possible for the Earth to sustain the current pace of development and exploitation of its resources. Impossible. So what kind of civilization is it that destroys its own domicile, destroys its own home, and also destroys its own inner self? That you have to take into account. Now, some of the fears we have about Vedic knowledge is that, well, I don't want to be a full-time sadhu. And everything in the Vedas makes you into a sadhu or a rishi. As soon as you open Bhagavad Gita, you turn into a brahmachari. Many parents fear that. Oh, you tell us you're going to the temple there. Oh, don't get too much caught into that. You may lose your focus. A little bit of puja to whatever is okay a few minutes a day. Do puja for someone or something. That's the tendency in India, because even contemporary Indian life is coming from a very devotional culture, Krishna conscious culture. So people still have the tendency to be devoted to something, never mind what it is. Of course, the devotion is meant for Bhagavan Sri Krishna, but that's been forgotten. But still the tendency to be devoted is there, to something. Like when I was doing my test watching of television in Delhi, they were interviewing some new Bollywood star who had risen out of obscurity to become famous. And so he was going to see the premiere showing of his movie or something like that. And so he was talking. You always have to remember two things. That's the reason for my success. Love your audience. Respect your job. These principles were firmly established in me. Have devotion for your audience, your fans, and respect for your work. He said it in a very, like, this is very deep knowledge. Love your audience. Love your fans. Respect your work. I owe everything to two persons who believed in me more than I believed in myself. He actually had tears in his eyes. Yeah. He was saying it with such emotion, such bhava, such... Love your fans. Love your work. Of course, the movie was completely trashy, completely crazy. That's another thing. But the point is, I can see... He had to feel devotion for something, although it's so misplaced. He actually felt that his life was meaningful because he was respecting his job and loving his fans. So that is the sentiment that's still there now. Show puja for something, no matter what it is. Krishna, Nehru, somebody, whatever, you know. Find someone to show puja for. Wave some incense at something. Never mind. And only a few minutes a day. So there's this fear that as soon as I open Bhagavad Gita, as soon as I start hearing too much about Sanatana Dharma, I'll immediately renounce everything. I'll have to renounce everything. Your parents also have that fear. Oh, the spiritual life gets in the way of progress. But what is that progress? We've already discussed that point. Actually, Vedic knowledge, although it's so extraordinary, it presents different rates of speed for different persons. Vedic knowledge is very user-friendly, in that it recognizes not everyone's going to be an overnight transcendentalist.
an overnight sadhu. Now, certainly for those who want to try for that, the Vedic knowledge gives you the instructions and the facility to do that. But at the same time, the Vedic knowledge recognizes that most people are going to need a gradual path. So, don't have this false idea about the Vedic texts that they're simply for the sadhus. As soon as you touch Bhagavad Gita, you're wearing saffron. You can't marry, you can't work, you can't do anything practical. You just sit in one place and chant mantras. No. Actually, the Vedic knowledge is very comprehensive in terms of offering a gradual path so that you can have a material and spiritual balance. Krishna talks about this in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. Whenever and wherever there's a decline in the balance, it's called dharmasya glani, means the balance between material and spiritual affairs. Whenever that balance is disturbed, Krishna comes. Balance means balance. There has to be the proper emphasis on your material side, which is not so important, but still it has to be there. And then, of course, the proper emphasis on your spiritual side. That is the real Vedic message. Not that as soon as you chant Hare Krishna, then you're a full-time sadhu with no relation to the world. It's like sometimes people say to me, well, Swami, you have left the world completely, but what about us persons who live in the practical world? I said, wait a minute. What do you mean, I have left the world completely? This assumption is there. You have left the world completely, Swami. They say kind of a flowery, you have left the world completely. But we in the practical world. I said, I'm traveling all the time. Do you understand what is required for to travel all the time in this day and age? I said, I actually know more about traveling than a travel agent. When it's time for me to get my tickets for traveling around the world, I don't ask the travel agent. I tell the travel agent what to do. Give me this kind of ticket on this airline. Do like this, do like that. And the travel agents all say, hey, you know more than us. It's true. I've been traveling for a quarter of a century. So how is that being away from the world? The point is, I'm not traveling for selfish purposes. If the world is Krishna's energy, why shouldn't we be expert in using the world for Krishna's pleasure? I haven't turned my back on the world. I've just changed my utilization of the world. That's all. You can do the same thing as a family person, as a householder person, or, who knows, very few of you might choose to live a single life. Whatever. The point is, how do you use the world? Not to turn your back on it and deny it, nor should you immerse yourself in it for your own selfish, hedonistic purposes. But instead, use the world. Recognize that it's Krishna's energy. Use it in Krishna's service. That this is the dynamic of bhakti yoga. Not denying the world. Once our founder, Srila Prabhupada, Murti you see on the Vyasa on there, he said a very provocative thing to make you think. There was a famous picture of a famous Indian impersonalist sadhu. And that sadhu was shown in front of a pile of gold, and he was like this. I am pure, I have nothing to do with it, I have turned my back on all that. So our Srila Prabhupada said, they should make a picture of us. It'll be different. We will. Why? Not for us, but for Krishna's use. That is the big difference. Very provocative example. You have to think about it, because according to Indian sentiment, well, sadhus, they don't touch anything. But Srila Prabhupada's example was, yes, the sadhu uses everything for Krishna's pleasure. Why should we deny it if it belongs to Krishna? What we do deny is the selfish use of things, but we don't deny the things. Therefore, this Krishna conscious movement needs so many skills, it needs so much input, not to turn your back on the world. If, for example, if I just go to a travel agent and say, please, give me a ticket that covers 5 continents, tell me what to do, I'll get this big bill at the end, right? It's just like if you don't know anything about cars and you go to buy a used car, you know what's going to happen. Similarly, if you don't know anything about traveling, then you'll be taken advantage of. So for the sake of Krishna's service, I had to learn all about ticketing and airlines like that, so as not to waste Krishna's money. Now, on my own, I'd rather not have to deal with that. I could just be reading shlokas and Bhagavad Gita. Yeah. But for Krishna's service, I have to do the necessary, because it's Krishna's money. It's not my money. The money is for Krishna's pleasure. Well, this is the dynamic of bhakti yoga. It's far from turning your back on the world. It is the proper using of the world with the best intelligence and expertise that you have. Just like Arjuna, he fought the battle of Kurukshetra. That meant he had to use his best military abilities. Krishna didn't tell Arjuna, I'll just go sleep in the back of the chariot, I'll do everything. No, Krishna told him, Mama Nusma, Yudhyam Cha, fight and think of me. In other words, devotion in action, and the purpose of the action is my pleasure. Now, sometimes this is misinterpreted, that the message of Bhagavad Gita means, whatever you do, just do it with devotion, and then you enjoy all the results. Do your duty! And you then are entitled to all the fruits. But what does Krishna say in the second chapter of Gita? He says, you are entitled to do your duty. You must do your duty, but you're not entitled to the results. So many places I go to in India, they say, oh, but Krishna says you must do your duty. And I say, well, what about the other part of the verse? Swamiji, what other part of the verse? I say, let us turn to Bhagavad Gita. Let's find the other part of the verse. Oh, you are entitled to your duty, but you're not entitled to the results. So therefore, we need so much skill, so much intelligence for giving people real knowledge. So we shouldn't be fearful. Oh no, I'll lose all my skills, I'll lose all my expertise by chanting Hare Krishna. No. The Vedas completely recognize that there has to be a balance of the material and spiritual. There are different orders of life. So, in some orders of life, brahmacharya and sannyas, you have a different lifestyle than the householder order of life. Still, the purpose of all those orders is spiritual advancement. They're just different styles how to achieve that. So, don't fear that the more I immerse myself in this wonderful Krishna conscious knowledge and process, I may risk becoming materially dull. In fact, you'll find that your sharpness increases because your mind is not so fuzzy with so many crazy desires. That's what's destroyed Western so-called civilization. That's why you have the competitive edge for employment, because everybody else's minds are destroyed by the very civilization that you're trying to embrace. You have the competitive edge because your minds are sharp. Why are your minds sharp? Because they're not full of wildness that is so prevalent everywhere. So why should we have this conception, that this fear, this paranoia? Oh, if I go to the spiritual side, I'll lose my material sharpness. No. Actually, the more Krishna conscious you become, the more expert you become at doing so many things. you actually have more ability than anyone else because your senses and mind are controlled, your powers of focus and concentration are so magnified. This is what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Vyavasyatmaka bhujya ekeha kuru nandana bahushaka hyanantascha budayo vyavasayana. For those who are in bhakti, Sanatana Dharma, Krishna consciousness, their focus, their aim is one. But bahushaka hyanantascha, those who are in material life, they're irresolute. Their intelligence is many branched. They can't focus. And the proof is, that's why you get the jobs. That's the proof. So just see the paradox that you're confronting. The thing that's giving you the competitive edge is the thing that you're turning your backs on. It's very short-sighted. Why not embrace the thing that's giving you the competitive edge? The thing that's giving you the competitive edge is the culture of Sanatana Dharma, which fosters a modest lifestyle of sense control, integrity, responsibility. You know how these Westerners live. You've seen it, right? Wild. It's astonishing. You can't believe it, right? How can people go on like that? At the same time, by contact with them, you're taking up that influence. That's what the TV is. Oh, look at that. The movies. Wow. And you contemplate doing things that your grandmother would faint at if she knew you were thinking like that. Right? We're here in Australia. It's all part of, you know, being in Australia. We don't have to go to the extreme that the other people do, right? We're not going to go to that extreme. This is how you brainwash yourself. But, you know, just to experience life here, you know, a little bit of these things, you know, not an overdose, a little bit of these things. No. Once your senses go out of control, then they go way out of control. And the proof is, you'll see in your children. They'll be the proof. That there's no stopping point. Mm-hmm. Once you go that route, you go that route. Mm. So please don't have this fear, this bias, and understand where the bias comes from. This false charge that Vedic knowledge is simply for the pure transcendentalist. That is totally untrue. How is it that you'll experience what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita? Because you don't want mythology. And Krishna is certainly not offering you mythology. If you want to experience what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you apply the process and you'll see. What could be more appropriate than that? You enter the bhakti laboratory, you'll see the results. And then you'll start to understand where from all this Vedic culture, where from all this family tradition came. It'll all start to click for you. You'll see what is the point of it all. But if you don't understand the point, then gradually you'll forget all about these cultural expressions, just like so many children are doing now who come from parents from India. And children are not impressed because the parents can't explain to the children what's the point of it all. Okay, let us celebrate Diwali now. Why celebrate Diwali? Well, this is just what our family does. Let us go once a year for Janmashtami. Why are we going to go once a year for Janmashtami? Oh, because your grandfather did it. So this is what's happening. All right, we'll pause here for some questions. I know I've been talking about touchy things.
Normally,
Okay, one at a time. There'll be time for everyone.
Normally, the Westerners speak on our culture in the form of asking why you have so many caste system, and then you make people poor, underprivileged, and destitute, poverty, hunger. So we don't have any answer because I mean, we see that, you know, how it happens.
How can you allow yourself to be intimidated by this bogus propaganda? Okay, first of all, yes, it is wrong, this caste system. That is not what Krishna talks about in Bhagavad Gita, that you are relegated to a certain caste because of birth. That's not Vedic. That's a concoction. What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Guna karma vibhagasha. According to your quality and your activity, you get a certain designation. Just like you may be born from a father who's a lawyer. Does that mean you're automatically a lawyer?
No.
How many of you are going to choose a doctor when you're very sick simply because, well, his father was a doctor, so? No, you want to see the qualification. You want to see the activity. His performance. Guna karma. Quality and performance. So in nowhere in Vedic tradition are you a Brahmana by birth. Now you see what happened. Now this is something hard to understand for modern people. What happened was that naturally certain families would perpetuate a certain quality of child because these families were practicing proper production of children in the proper consciousness. That's why Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says, Dharma Garuda Bhuteshu Kamosri Paratarshava. I am the procreation of children according to Dharma. I am that. In other words, when the parents properly produce children according to the appropriate religious practices, then you can count on a certain quality of children perpetuating the family standard. So certain families became very famous for pure and competent children. It wasn't because of genetics, it was because of the family's ability to preserve purity. So therefore, at some point, it was generally true that the son of a Brahmana would be a Brahmana because of the parents' ability to maintain their family line. Not simply physically, but also in terms of the quality of consciousness. But the reason for that perpetuation of a certain quality of child has been forgotten. And so therefore people just think automatically, my father's a Brahmana, therefore I'm a Brahmana. Krishna says quite clearly in Bhagavad Gita, according to the quality and the performance of the child, he's classified. I just had an amusing example. A few years ago in New Zealand, I might have told you about it. I had to mediate a fight between two Indian families in Auckland. There was the woman, she was in her 20s, the man, he was in his early 30s. So they had been seeing each other, and then the woman became pregnant, and so quickly the two families on both sides, the girl's side, the man's side, they wanted to patch the situation up quick to avoid social stigma by, you know, that there be a marriage. No one will, you know. But then there was a hitch. The family on the young man's side found out that this girl is not from a Brahmana family. We are a Brahmana family. How can our son marry her? But then the girl's family is saying, wait, but she's pregnant. We have to hurry up. Let there be the marriage ceremony quickly. Next week, 2 weeks, we don't want this getting out, you know. So they're having this big fight. So they called me to arbitrate. So I had to break the news to the young man's family. Excuse me, but he's not a Brahmana. Brahmanas do not impregnate women outside of marriage. Oh, really, Swami? And then, in an indirect, gentle way, I said, and in so many words, I said, and by the way, you're not a Brahmana family. And so, they had no relation whatsoever with even the most external things of Vedic culture, Indian culture, however you want to call it. They had nothing at all. They had been in New Zealand for a couple of generations and they were basically just brown-skinned New Zealanders. But still they were holding on to this idea, we are a Brahmana family.
how come I've so unmarried this girl? So I just had to break the news to them. Excuse me, but what's done is done, let the marriage go on. I knew both of the girl and the boy. Let the marriage go on. He's not a brahmana.
So the manuscript is not really existent. It is a concoction, the manuscript.
Manusunhita?
Yeah.
It doesn't say, nowhere in Vedic literature is it stated that you are a particular varna, like caste, by birth. It's a complete concoction. It's a concoction perpetuated by the by degraded brahmanas who want to hold a monopoly. That's what it's coming from. And it has destroyed Vedic culture in India. Therefore, India does get part of the blame. It's not all England's fault. This concoction is just so powerful. Does that answer your question? I was once in Delhi about 4 years ago, and I had to get a, what do you call them? In different countries they call them different, I think in South America they call them trikes, or is it in India they call them trikes? These motor rickshaws?
Auto
rickshaws. So the rickshaw driver, he drove me, you know, I had to go to some consulate, and then as I got out, he wanted to charge me more money. And I, of course, said, no, we stick to the price we agreed on. And then he argued, and I wouldn't agree. And then he reached under his dirty T-shirt, and he did like this to me.
Brahma, you have to do what I say. I just laughed, put the right amount of money in his hand, and walked off. So, yes, this notion has caused great havoc in India. Now, I'll answer the other part of your question. Because when Westerners point the finger, you've got the caste system there, it's responsible for so much social exploitation. What about their own societies? There's no social exploitation there?
The different names.
Exploitation goes on everywhere in the material world under different names, whether it's socialism, capitalism, whatever ism, there's always exploitation when there's not pure God consciousness. You can count on that as a fact. Everywhere you look, you'll find exploitation. It'll always be there when you don't have proper understanding of spiritual values in society. America's complete exploitation. Russia, complete exploitation. They just have a different way of going about it, that's all. Yes.
Just before I ask that question, I want to comment the way exploitation is done again. Like, say, if we go to McDonald's or KFC's, they don't hire if you are more than 21 of your age because they need to pay more. So in the name of just helping the younger kids, so that they pay literally 1/4 of the amount what they pay. And they say we are helping the younger kids to
do. Do you know what happened to a scientific test that was recently done for someone who ate at McDonald's every day for 1 month straight? Yeah, you heard about that? Complete health wreck. Yes, horrible health. And why is it now in Australia and New Zealand that companies want to hire people as, what do you call, not as full employee, but contract. Why?
They want to get rid of the obligations of full time.
Exactly. Yes. That's exploitation. I know one devotee, he's a flight attendant for Air New Zealand. He told me that the company has gotten rid of all their long-standing employees who are flight attendants, because they know that after 2 years of flying every day, you'll get so sick, and then the company has to pay your medical benefits in the future. Better just take people on contract for a year or two and then cut them after 2 years. So, and this way, you don't, the company has, doesn't have to worry about anyone's medical benefits.
This is all just exploitation in a different way. So why do they always just point the finger at India? Oh, casteism. Oh. You shouldn't fall for this. It's just a trip they lay on you. Casteism. Meanwhile, let us sell our products in your country. Our products are produced by free laborers. Wholesome American laborers. Of course, now they don't even want factories in America because the labor price is too high. So they're putting their own people out of work and they're looking, where is a place for cheap labor? So now you have so many call centers in India. Just like if you call in Australia, New Zealand, to Dell Computers because you want some service, the calls goes to Malaysia. The service centers in Malaysia. So, this is what's going on.
Our Atma has got a lot of rituals which we do in daily life, but sometimes we do just because it is written somewhere or somebody told us. So if there is an explanation is available to the people, probably they can follow it more diligently instead of just following because somebody was doing it. So is the thing is documented somewhere so that one can go through the logic or rationale of doing those things or not doing those things?
That is why Krishna speaks Bhagavad Gita. Mm. Yes, exactly. If you read an authorized version of Bhagavad Gita, that's why we have Bhagavad Gita as it is, instead of Bhagavad Gita as we would like it to be. We have Bhagavad Gita as it is because it presents Krishna's words straight. Mm. And if you take what Krishna says, you'll know what's the purpose of all these rituals. That's why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Vedaishta Sarvai Ahameva Veda, by all the Vedas, I am to be known. The purpose of all the rituals is me, Krishna said. Mm. So yes, that's why so much of our effort in Krishna consciousness is meant for educating people. Mm. You see, the Krishna consciousness movement is doing an amazing thing. It's doing two things at once, and that's never been done before. Mm. And now that you're in the West, you'll appreciate this wonder. Especially outside of India, this Krishna consciousness movement is teaching people how to be human beings and transcendentalists at the same time. Never been done before. Usually when Vedic culture is properly in place, they're all the gradual structures there for producing a gradual spiritual evolution in a person. But all those structures have been destroyed. In India, they've been destroyed. In the West, they never existed. So what Srila Prabhupada did was to present a system whereby which people could become a human being and a transcendentalist at the same time. Never been done before. And then, because now India is losing its culture, it's losing the systems for gradual development, we have to do the same thing in India. We have to remind people in India, don't throw out these systems, they have a purpose.
So do we have any plans to have schools where we can bring back people to the Vedic culture, Vedic way of education from the Krishna consciousness movement?
You mean schools for children to go to? Well, hopefully some of you, if you settle in Australia, you'll consider that. Our job is huge. Our task is monumental. We need help. That's why I laugh when I hear fears, phobias among you that, if I take up Sanatana Dharma, if I take up Bhakti Yoga, I won't be able to use my skills, I'll have to turn my back on the world. For a school, you need skilled people, teachers, administrators. So, hopefully some of you will do that.
Just to add a comment on what you have said, the West Bank, India as well is to be blamed for not accepting Vedic culture, Vedic knowledge. you know, I read it somewhere recently in a newspaper that one of the reasons, like, there was a finding of Saraswati River, you have mentioned in your book, elaborately on subsequently, I read in the newspaper that the one of the reasons why they don't want to do archaeological survey on Saraswati River is political reason. Because if it is known that the you know, the civilization has not come from middle of the Asia or somewhere else to India, and the civilization was actually from India, and so then you have got this division of Dravida and Arya.
Yes.
You know, it could create a lot of hazards within the country. So they want to avoid finding out, you know, doing any archaeological work on Saraswati River project.
You have to understand that academic research is bound up with politics. If you're studying IT, you know that. Everything at university has politics connected to. So, if you have archaeological funds at your disposal, and you're from the West, it's much more attractive to go to the Middle East and dig into the roots of the Bible like that, because it's more compatible with the Western culture. Bible research is very popular. Millions of dollars goes into biblical research, finding the archaeological basis of the Bible. They'll spend so much money researching lost Viking culture because Vikings are Europeans. But India is so strange to the Western mind. It's just a completely different universe that they don't like to touch it. It's because of cultural bias. I've talked about these things in my book, and I've documented them all. You'd be shocked how little archaeological research has been done in India. It's just not a priority. Everything at a university requires prioritization. Just like now someone was telling me how, and maybe, I don't know if it's RMIT or some other institution in Melbourne, they've completely cut back on their IT department. Used to be a big cash cow. Now, it's not profitable anymore. That's the way universities work. They have to be financially viable, you know? So it's not very financially attractive to study ancient India. And especially since the conception that ancient India is backwards, it had a very undeveloped past, that's still there. So no one considers it to be a priority.
And in fact, I actually went into Archaeological Survey of India site, you know, after reading your book, just to understand, is India recognizing its own culture, you know, its own findings? You know, unfortunately, even there, I find a lot of Max Muller.
Yes.
Yes.
You go to Delhi, and the name of the German consul is called Max Muller Bavar.
Yes. Every city has now.
Yes.
City has got
every city. Yes. He's a deva. He was paid by the British government to just disparage, to make fun of everything Indian, but they worship it.
He said it's documented, so why don't we show this to the people who put these names on their buildings?
Well, that is up to you. I got the information in my book.
You know, actually, this is the point I was trying to make. I mean, the reason why the Saraswati River project was stopped by India, within India, because, you know, the political reason between two different parties, you know, one is religious oriented party, not religious party, you know, like, you know, BJP authority, let me come out. You know, it's, you know, the Congress is afraid that tomorrow, if it is formed, that the society was in existence in India, you know, and it's more of a Hindu thing will happen. So it could create hazards between Dravida and, you know, that is South and North. India, so they want to avoid, you know.
All right, listen to this statement by Max Muller. He wrote about his mission. He wrote this to his wife in 1896. He's talking about his translation works. I hope I shall finish the work And I feel convinced, though I shall not live to see it, that the edition that I'm producing and my translation of the Vedas will hereafter tell to a great extent on the fate of India. It is the root of their religion, and to show them what that root is, I feel sure, is the only way of uprooting all that has sprung from India during the last 3,000 years. So he was paid by the British East India Company to translate the Vedic texts in a way that would destroy Indians' reverence for the Vedic texts. So much of scholarship is like that. Just like right now at Oxford, the Sanskrit chair is known as the Bowdoin chair. That Bowdoin chair, still there at Oxford, the chief Sanskritist at Oxford University holds the Bowdoin chair. That chair was funded in the 1800s by a certain Colonel Bowdoin, who had made a big fortune in India. And he funded that chair saying, we need a professor and a line of professors who can destroy everything Indian. So let me fund the Bowdoin chair. They named it after him. So whoever took that chair as the chief Sanskritist at Oxford, his mission was to translate the Vedas in such a way that no one will believe them. This is what money does.
But why did they have to do it?
Because they wanted to control India. They're smart. If they get you to not believe that you had any glorious past, then you're easy to control. But as long as you think you had a glorious past, you won't accept the Western ways and you won't be a good market. It's business.
Kicking away the aboriginal children.
So many things. Why did you live a simple life? I want you to buy my products. I want you to feel a hankering for my products. You're too satisfied with your religion and your spiritual beliefs. Let me take all that away, and then you'll understand that you should simply be a materialist and be happy. But remember the statistics I just quoted you from the UN, that in terms of the contemporary standards of psychological happiness, the poorest country in the world is number one for the most happy people. Isn't that amazing?
You know, I totally agree. We find that quite a lot in India, rural India, when you go, and it's like extremely happy people, you know, like they may have, you know, hardly anything, but
coming to nothingness is happiness. You have to come to nothingness to be happy.
No, you don't have to come to nothingness to be happy. What you have, you're content with, and you use it for the best purpose. That's why I was talking earlier. There's this fear. Oh, spiritual life, Sanatana Dharma, Krishna consciousness means giving up everything, just going back to Indian village life. No. I'm not living Indian village lifestyle. I don't have any property except my suitcase. I have a laptop. I have a watch. But, you know, I don't have my home. But I'm not living a village lifestyle. As I said, I can tell you more about flying than a travel agent can tell you. But it's not for my selfish purposes.
No, what's the meaning of this one? Nothingness is, when he starts getting something, human being tendency is something more, never it will stop.
So how do you stop?
That is what controlling the senses.
And why should you control your senses?
Controlling the senses is ultimately what the purpose. Because you have to keep a sharp mind. What is that is required is keeping a sharp mind.
But you want pleasure. How can you control your senses when you want pleasure?
Pleasure. See, pleasure and senses. Let me relate it. I will relate the when senses and pleasure. If you have the control over the senses, you are focusing. What if our Krishna consciousness moment, what it says, at the lotus feet or something. When we start focusing on
something. Puja for something. Come on. Nothing. Just do puja.
On the other side, there is nothingness. Come towards me, there is nothingness. We are doing everything for nothingness to keep ourselves happy. That is what I believe. Because if we start telling something, as he said, we should try and build some school. So I ultimately, what is the thing is, I don't want to live Australia. I will have to be in Australia.
must make my children go into it. If at all that is the case, let us go to India. Make some. We don't want to leave Australia. We want to go to England, this way, that way. But we have to see that money is there with me. That is what I feel it. Whether my this one is right or wrong, but
I appreciate your honesty. I appreciate very much your honesty.
I think the exploitation by the Westerners of Indian Indianness and the Indian values is still going on, because last year I think the Americans, they tried to interpret to the United Nations that there is a racism within India, which they call this casteism is nothing but racism.
Americans are always trying to convince everybody else they've got the problems. They're always trying to do it. That's part of their dharma. And then, once they make you feel bad about yourself, what's next? Open up your market. Here we go. That's the American trip.
It happened in Indonesia. Yeah.
You need democracy. You need free market systems. You need us to sell our products to you.
Just hang on. Human rights.
Human rights, right. Yeah, sure. You have the right to buy our products. Like one American president in the 20th century said, you know what the business of America is? Business. So whenever they say something, whenever an American president says something, always look for the bottom line. Whether they're going into Iraq or whatever, there's always the bottom line. Where's the money? I know, I went to school with so many of these people. I know exactly how they think. Alright. Yes.
We say that one of the problems is economy and economical progress, but one of the four progress in life in our religion is Artha, that means economical progress. So how that is different from this economical progress which is proposed by Western civilization?
Economic progress, according to the Shastra, doesn't destroy everything in its path. That's what's happening now. The so-called economic progress today is destroying people's inner life, it's destroying the environment, the very world that people live in, and it can't be sustained. Therefore, there's always boom and bust, boom and bust. Maybe some of you started studying IT during the boom days. Now what happens? Do you call that economic progress? You spend so much of your time studying IT, just like one of my disciples, Bhagavad Kata, he's coming from Calcutta. He's to study. So many years he studied IT here. Now he's graduating. Next week he's finishing school. What was he thinking to do? While going to school, he was working in a food market. And so the managers at the food market told him, it was a chain, they told him, look, why are you risking with the IT world? You stay with us, we'll elevate you in the management system of this food market chain. And he realized, yes, you're right. The IT world's very shaky. Why should I look to IT for employment? Here today, gone tomorrow. So though he studied IT for so many years, now the food market, yes, that is a more stable position. So, you call this economic progress, that someone studies so many years a particular field and then the field collapses? So much distress? How many people did IBM lay off in Australia?
3,000 odd in the last four years.
Yes. Budimant, he was telling me the technique I was explaining in our class. We talk about these things in Bhagavatam class also. We're not living in a dream world just because we're wearing saffron. We talk about these things. I know about them. He told me at his company, this is how they terminate you, lay you off. They do it on Friday morning because they don't want the whole rest of the company to get agitated by some senior or middle manager being laid off.
So they do it right before the weekend, so that people, you know, will go and have their weekend merriment and forget all about it, and then Monday they'll come back to work and they won't be so intense about the fact that people are losing jobs all around them. So they particularly do it on Friday. The man comes into work on Friday morning, and he sees the note that he's terminated. And they tell him, you have 30 minutes to clear your office and leave. Why 30 minutes? Because they're afraid you'll get so angry and you'll get on the computer system and crash the whole system. So they want to get you out really quick before you can, you know, crash their IT system. So they just tell you, you've got 30 minutes. You've been working there, giving your life and soul for decades, and they tell you, you've got 30 minutes to clear your office and go. So Budimant was telling me, sometimes these men, these executives, they can't even drive themselves home. There's such emotional wrecks after this, after hearing this, that the company has to call them a taxi or send someone to drive them home. You can imagine, you built yourself up, you're rising on the corporate ladder, you're leaving home to go to work, you know, your wife's probably working too, she's getting the children ready to go to school, and so you get into your nice car, you drive to work, and then you find out you're terminated, and you have to turn around and go home to see your wife and children who are just now leaving, and they have to see you come back from work. And they're, Father, why are you here? And you're looking completely devastated, and right in front of your family, you have to admit, I have no job now. This is what goes on. This is very destructive economic progress. Rises and falls. So when the Vedic knowledge talks about artha, it's not referring to that kind of artificial economic expansion. It's talking about doing the economic necessities for living a simple life in God consciousness. It's really different. Just like the Vedic knowledge talks about kama, it talks about sense gratification. But how you can get your share of sense gratification without destroying yourself. That's what the Vedas are speaking about. So why you bring up simply artha? Why not kama too? That's there. The Vedic system is, you take one wife, you're satisfied with her. And what is the current system? No one is satisfied with anyone, just change them right and left all the time. And what are you going to tell your children here in Australia when they want to do like that? Huh? What are you going to say? Huh? Right, because they're honest, and I don't know. Well, your mother and I, we did not live like that. Your children are not going to want to hear that. But everyone in Australia has so many girlfriends and boyfriends. What's the big deal?
Yeah, but that is also going on everywhere else, as in all over the world. It's so prevalent in India as well today.
I know, I wasn't going to say that. I know, Budimant, he just moved back from Melbourne to Delhi after 11 years. He told me 11 years ago, boy and girl, they, you know, if they wanted to be together, they had to be very clandestine, they had to be very secretive. And now everywhere he looks in Delhi, boys and girls holding hands together, embracing in public, it's just normal now.
I just come down from Delhi 2 weeks back. Mm-hmm. So I've been in Delhi for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I know how it is. It's not the same anymore.
Right.
The way we've been brought up and the kids today, it's very different.
Yes, very different. This is the point, that unless you know the reason why you're following these rules and protocols and traditions, you'll give them up. If you've forgotten the spiritual purpose, which is to become Krishna conscious, it'll all fade.
And the would-be Prime Minister himself is in that position, Rahul Gandhi, I think.
Hmm?
Rahul Gandhi. He himself has a girlfriend, probably young girlfriend. So it is the idealistic for the youngsters.
One incident I just wanted to share with you. I was working in a call center. My job is just to make phone calls to people and sell products over the phone. It's more of telemarketing. Last month I just made a phone call to one house. One child, she picked up the phone. Then I asked her, can I speak to your mom? She said, my mom is inside the room. Can you please call your mom? No, I should not disturb her. She will beat me. Why? She is with her boyfriend. A small kid. She may be around not even 4 or 5 years.
Do you know what the British technological advanced responses to England's being the teen pregnancy capital of Europe is? You know what they're... Brilliant, very technological. Progress. The government has established a new program, amply funded, that any teenage girl in England can sign up for this. That you sign up and the government will send a message to your mobile phone every week. Did you remember to take your pills? It's technology advancement. Using the technology properly. And in case you are from a family in which your mother would freak out, she'd become angry if she saw you get this message on your mobile, the government will send you an alternative message, coded, like, did you remember to call Paul? Which means, did you remember to take your bill? That is their answer to their being the teen pregnancy capital of Europe. So this is progress? This is what you want? And yet, these kind of persons will just make fun of Vedic culture, or they make fun of it in a modern way, which is, oh, these myths are very enlivening. These myths are very interesting. It's all part of the contemporary cultural fabric, these myths of India. They're kind of condescending. How colorful your myths are. It adds such color to the world, your people's myths. You have to find out for yourself, is this myth or is it not? You owe yourself that responsibility. I've made that investigation. I don't have any doubts. But you have to convince yourself by taking up the practice of Krishna consciousness, studying Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and you'll see. The only reason why I've accumulated so much information in this book about scientific knowledge, archaeological knowledge, sociological knowledge, is just to relieve you of this false inferiority complex. If I just sit up here and say, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, okay, thank you, Swamiji. So I have to relieve you of your false sense of inferiority that, oh, India is backwards, it's very mythological, Vedic knowledge is all legend. So I had to put so much work to do that for your sake. Otherwise, I could just easily just talk what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. It's fine with me.
With your kind permission, I'd like to... I read that book, mm-hmm. and I know what... I read quite a lot. I just want to make a few comments on the book, you know, to the other friends here. Is it okay? You know, actually, I took this book from ISKCON, and, you know, I started reading first few pages. You know, I like the title Vedic In Search of Vedic India. So I thought, I didn't expect there is going to be something very interesting there. I thought, oh, let me give it a try. Just took that book. I must say that when I started reading that book, I read continuously for 8 hours. Continuously, because I couldn't stop reading that book, like any so-called novels you find, you know. when you keep reading them, so interesting. In the same way, this was very interesting because every chapter had at least 40-50, I exactly can't say the number, but large number of references. A very well-researched book. And it establishes large number of facts, number one, to prove that these Vedas are right, you know, that these Vedas are not mythological and they have not come out of some poet's imagination. But number two, the civilization, there is an assumption that the human civilization has been in existence only for 1,500 or 2,000 years or whatever it is, very short period. This book establishes scientifically that human civilization has been in existence in this world, on this earth, for millions of years, okay, with a large number of recorded evidences proving that point. Number three,
you know, the there is also an assumption that the people from middle of Asia or from Europe have walked into India. There was no civilization existing at that point in time, and they have carried with them Sanskrit language as well as Vedic knowledge, okay, and distributed and brought the culture to India. Okay. It has been beyond doubt, it has been proved in that book, okay, that it is not so. This has been in existence for millions of years. Another very interesting thing is so-called scientific advancements, okay, you know, have all been there in the past culture, in the Vedic culture. The book clearly establishes that, you know, with so many references, with so much of references to the literature, that no, this knowledge has been available. In this world, which has not been, you know, the whatever mental advances we are talking about is not something new. And now there is a big interest that interplanetary travel, you know, that US wants to conduct some, yeah, travel and all that. And this book also establishes that, you know, that the earlier civilization was able to travel across the planets. And another thing is, you know, the there is no life, there is a belief, scientific belief that in certain environment only the life can exist, in terms of temperature, in terms of, you know, the water availability, you know, climatic conditions and all that. You know, the same science today is denying that, okay, no, the fact is, the thing is wrong. The bacteria can exist in a very, very difficult situation, like thermophiles. They can exist in a very, very high temperatures of 45, 50, 60 degrees centigrade. So it means that definitely the beings are present in other planets as well, where the climatic conditions are very harsh. It's an excellent book. My personal recommendation is, it deserves an absolute reading by every person who is present. This is my
purpose. Alright. Okay, so when is our next session?
We started around 4:30.
Alright. Okay.
Maharaj, last question.
Okay.
Many people recognize that today, whatever the world is happening, they could able to correct the facts that finally that this is all because of lack of spirituality.
Mm.
And the people who recognize that this is lack of spirituality, like being below poverty line, and what you call as so mental depression.
Mm. All right. Okay, so when is our next session?
We started around 4:30.
All right. Okay.
Maharaj, last question.
Okay.
Many people recognize that today, whatever the world is happening, they could able to correct the facts that finally that this is all because of lack of spirituality.
Mm.
And the people who recognize that this is lack of spirituality, like being below poverty line, and what you call as so mental depression, mm, and all these kind of things. And the people who could find out that what all these facts are because of lack of spirituality, they read Vedas, they know the culture, and but they are unable to do anything to make the people know of the culture.
Mm.
So what do you think that to be done by those people?
Without purity, you can't do anything. So that's why what we're doing here is building a caliber of person who has the purity to actually make an effect on this world.
Okay, so fine.
Will you help?
One second. But the person whom I'm talking is, mm-hmm, is a great devotee of Lord Rama.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a Muslim, but he worships a lot to Rama, mm-hmm, than he worships Allah. And he reads a lot of Vedic culture,
mm-hmm,
and he plays Sri Raga, which is a very favorite to Lord Rama.
Mm-hmm. We are open to help from all sections. We are non-sectarian in that let us all cooperate to reestablish genuine spiritual practices in this world. If you want to do that as this religion, that religion, that's all right. We just say that you won't find any more comprehensive spiritual knowledge available for the human being than what is in the Vedic knowledge. That's all. It's just like the difference between an unabridged dictionary and a pocket dictionary. We don't criticize the pocket dictionaries. But the fact is, if you can access an unabridged dictionary, why don't you take it? So we need persons who will demonstrate this Vedic knowledge in action. That is what Krishna consciousness is about. Persons who are willing, for the sake of themselves and the world, persons who will develop the high qualities and show that what we're talking about is not mythology, it's not legend. So we're looking for those who will help to do that. And it doesn't mean you have to be a full-time sadhu to do that. It doesn't mean you have to be a brahmachari, leave your job, never marry. These are all just unnecessary phobias, paranoias. I'm just the way I am. I'm a minority in terms of, you know, being single, you know, like that, you know, not having family. But then again, I have a huge family. I have a huge spiritual family all over the world. There's always specialists in every field, right? Okay, so I am a specialist. Don't think that everyone's going to be a specialist. We want that there are very nice spiritual families, Krishna conscious families. We want that people demonstrate how to work with integrity, with spiritual integrity. Not just working for selfish purposes, but they use the proceeds from their work not simply to support themselves, but to help for the betterment of the world in Krishna consciousness. We need that. And there'll always be a few who want to be a specialist. That's all right. Okay?
One thing last, maybe. Violence is prohibited. So
where?
That's what we hear when we go to the temple. We shouldn't harm anybody. We should kill the jiva. So, my question is,
what is this book?
No, this is book.
No. What is this book?
Bhagavad Gita as it is.
Right.
Full of violence.
What is this cover?
Full of violence.
Yeah, that's right. If you are doing for a particular karma, that's what I heard in the lecture, that yes, that is not a violence. But what Raja Dashrath, who was king at that time, why he was going to jungle and killing that deer or whatsoever? What violence that was it for a particular karma or?
Arjuna, you mean? What?
No, Dashrath. King Dashrath.
Ram's father, he had to go hunting.
Yes.
Ram's father.
Right.
In Gita, it is stated
that. So you're asking why Dashrath went hunting?
Yeah.
Because the Kshatriya class, the warriors, the Vedic warriors, are allowed to kill animals that are harmful or else very insignificant animals for the purpose of practicing the killing art, because they're warriors and they use their killing art to maintain dharma, because there's always a criminal element. They never kill cows, but ferocious animals, lions, tigers, like that, wild boars, the Vedic warrior can practice the killing art with them. Because you have to have someone to protect society. There's always going to be a criminal element that likes to sell drugs, likes to kill, assault people. It's always going to be there.
But he was going for pleasure, not for serving the society. That's what he did.
Dasarath?
Yeah.
He was a very, very dharmic king. What's wrong with him taking pleasure in his duty?
Pleasure and duty is fine, but killing some innocent animal.
No. That is allowed according to the Vedic texts. A Vedic warrior, Kshatriya, can kill animals for the purpose of practicing the killing art. So that when the battle comes against unrighteous elements, his skills are sharp. So
those animals they bring back and they offer in the sacrifice, so they are immediately given the life.
That's another thing, that's brahmanas, that's dealing with animals in sacrifice. And also that is not allowed in this present age because the brahmanas are not so expert in their mantras that they can actually bring the animal back to life. In other words, there are very few real brahmanas. A lot of pretenders.
Now, this cockroach, this small jiva, can you kill it?
Because better you keep your house so clean that there are no cockroaches.
I'm cleaning my house. I still find them. So what do we do? I'm also Kshatriya. Should I tell that?
You're a Kshatriya?
Yeah.
How? What is your occupation?
My father told me.
Who told you that you're a Kshatriya?
That's what I'm telling you. His father, his grandfather, whosoever.
Well, what, okay, that may be, but what about you? You see, don't you see your muscles?
By a moment, I don't say it was a Kshatriya.
What is your occupation then? What?
Mine is certainly electric engineering.
Doesn't sound like a Kshatriya occupation to me.
He needs a lot of people.
So,
you wanted to go to the army?
No.
You had to go to the front lines in Kashmir?
Stop gaming.
So what is it about being Kshatriya? Yeah,
that's a definition. Who said can give that definition?
No. Definition is given by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Yeah.
Not the grandparents.
Right. You want to find out what a Kshatriya is, you read Krishna's definition in Bhagavad Gita. You give protection. You're courageous in battle. You never turn your back in battle. You have a controlling nature, Ishwar Bhava. For the sake of protecting people, you control. And you act only according to Dharma. That is a Kshatriya. All right.
Just a comment about animal killing. I read the Mahabharata, and I'm not sure the version was correct or what, but Krishna and Arjuna also went to the forest and they were engaged in that sort of activity. Very clearly states that animals which cause disturbance in the harmony of the jungle, the community, the ecosystem, the animals which create disturbance, they only kill those animals, not for their pleasure or just so that it's fun or anything like that. It's very clear.
Our understanding.
Why are you picking on this one thing?
Has created.
Why are you picking on this one thing? Why are you picking on this one thing?
No, reason is because I'm under confusion. Like I have got in my house cockroaches. Should I kill it or should I not kill it?
You should become a real Brahmana. Yeah. Keep your house so clean that there's no cockroaches.
That's what I'm saying. I'm keeping a house clean. So it's happening. Maybe because the neighbor's house is coming. So I don't know.
The neighbor's house.
That's what I mean.
Well, if you grew up in China, you'd eat them. There's always going to be some problem in this world. Better you focus on how you can become Krishna conscious. There's always going to be something that's a problem.
Some issue.
Some issue will always be there. You're not going to have it perfect. All right. Thank you very much.
So we come back here at around 1:30 for lunch prasad. And after that, we go for bushwalks for the ones who want to. We'll be going around. And then at around 4 o'clock we meet again, 4:30, for another session of lecture by Devendra Swami on the Vedic Self. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm not going to Gracias.